is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, December 27, 2004. On this holiday Monday, FSRN brings you a special documentary looking at one of George Bush's main allies, Australia, and its attack on human rights over the last few years. Please stay with us. Our special documentary today looks at criticisms that Australia has faced in recent years over its approach to human rights and focuses on two aspects of current government policy, its treatment of asylum seekers and its legislative response to the so-called War on Terror. Civil rights activists and international law specialists maintain that Australia's policy of mandatory detention of asylum seekers and its legislative response to the War on Terror represent violations of international law and impinge on key civil rights. However, government ministers remain adamant that the country has violated no international treaties and maintain that Australia has the right to protect its borders and its people from terrorist and other threats. During this next half hour, we join FSRN correspondent Erica Voles in Sydney as she takes a look at Australia's human rights engagements in the 21st century.
Earlier this year, the Secretary-General of Amnesty International, Irene Khan, told an assembled crowd of Australians at a keynote address that the framework of human rights, international law and multilateral cooperation that Australia had helped to forge was undergoing the most sustained attack since its establishment half a century ago. What was unique, though, was that she laid some of the blame squarely at the feet of Australia, claiming that, contrary to its heritage, Australia, far from resisting those attacks, is contributing to them. According to Margaret Reynolds, the President of the United Nations Association of Australia, Amnesty International is not alone in thinking this.
Australia has developed a really worrying reputation, and it's partly because Australia had such a strong commitment to human rights. So it is true that perhaps people judge Australia more harshly, but that's because people are just so surprised that Australian government has backed away from a very proactive stance on human rights.
So what has prompted these stinging rebukes? Over the next half hour, we'll take a look at some of the criticisms Australia has faced on two key aspects of the country's domestic policy, its approach to the issue of asylum seekers and refugees, and the legislative response to the War on Terror. While some observers claim Australia is breaking some of its human rights obligations, not everyone agrees. The Minister for Immigration, Amanda Vanstone, maintains Australia is standing by its key obligations, both internationally and to its own people.
International legal experts have argued that the policy of mandatory detention is damaging our standing overseas and creating ill will amongst nations less fortunate than ourselves. Do these long-term issues concern your department?
With respect, some people claim that. It's not the view of the majority of people, and certainly not the view of the Australian public, who have consistently re-elected the government and consistently re-elected a government that, as I say, is the third largest taker of refugees in need of resettlement in the world.
Federal Attorney General Philip Ruddock was previously the Immigration Minister. During his time in the role, he presided over the period of greatest outcry by civil libertarians to Australia's immigration policies towards refugees. As Attorney General, he also maintains Australia's current approach to the War on Terror is justifiable nationally and internationally.
Look, I know there are people around who have the view that any attempt at dealing with these issues ought to be seen as some reactionary operation by conservatives who have designs on tougher laws. That's just not the case. I make the point, and I think those who are interested in human rights and civil liberty groups ought to be, that governments have a very significant responsibility to protect the safety and security of their own peoples. And if you look at the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, it's one of the first and primary obligations.
What do you think of Australia's current policies towards asylum seekers and refugees?
I think that's an area that we're really letting down not only ourselves but also the rest of the international community. It's something that I'm embarrassed about as an Australian, and it doesn't seem to be a lot of noise about it or enough noise about it.
I generally probably think it's unfair for the majority of people that we're doing it to. But I think we have to have a policy and we have to draw a line in the sand. So, but I think it could improve.
That's a really tough one too. I'm sort of torn between both. I kind of see both sides of the fence.
We were told that once we will go to Australia, Australia has obligations to the United Nations, and you know, Australia is a country where our human rights and our freedom will be protected. So that's why we were quite happy when we arrived in Australia.
In recent years, Australia has won international condemnation for its approach to asylum seekers. A Labor government began the regime of mandatory detention in prison of all unauthorised refugees arriving in boats in 1992, ostensibly while their identity, status and claims were assessed. But it was under the present government that the system took on a tougher stance. In 2001, the government excised whole tracts of Australia's maritime zone from its migration zone under the Pacific Solution, which meant asylum seekers would have their claims processed in island nations like Nauru, with no appeal process. Margaret Reynolds, President of the UN Association of Australia.
Our treatment of asylum seekers is basically not only in breach of the spirit of the Geneva Convention, it's in breach of a number of other human rights conventions. And this is why countries that have looked to Australia for leadership in human rights are just aghast at the way in which we are treating and have treated asylum seekers in recent years.
At the height of the post-September 11 fallout, the government went so far as to claim that refugees may turn out to be terrorists, a claim eventually disputed by Dennis Richardson, the head of the intelligence body, ASIO, to a Senate committee. But even before September 11, it was a very hostile reception that refugees like Ahmed Riza Wakil received after making a dangerous boat journey from Indonesia to Australia. A member of Afghanistan's oppressed Hazara minority, he fled the country in fear for his life. He did not know he would be locked up upon arrival in Australia in 1999.
But when I found myself after a half-hour journey, when I found myself in detention centre, it was a bit of, you know, upsetting and shocking for me. But still, comparing to the situation we had in Afghanistan, it was satisfactory. I thought, okay, after a while we will go outside. But it wasn't for 30 days. In my personal case, it took more than 9 months until the department decided that I was a refugee and I did need Australian protection.
Compared to his hopes for a better life in Australia, his time in detention was the stuff of nightmares.
Not only myself, everyone in the detention centre was really very, very upset. There were children, there were families, there were teenage boys and girls. They were unaccompanied travellers, so it was very hard. We did see people going on hunger strike. We did see people sewing their lips together. And I cannot describe the time.
There is no such thing as illegal immigrants.
Riz believes that a country does have a right to check its own borders, but believes that detention that goes on for years behind maximum security conditions is unacceptable.
I will not say that the country does not have the right to check, but the problem is that when it comes to the globalization and free trade, all these governments say that we don't believe in borders. But when it comes to the desperate people who need the protection in Australia, while Australia can be more human and more supportive to these people, I think it's wrong to detain people. I completely do oppose mandatory detention. Australia have a very good history of helping people. While the Cambodian people were coming, there was no detention center. People from Vietnam, when they came to Australia, there was no detention center and there was no security threat at that time. The people did not disappear. They remained in the community, helped by the people in the Australian community. And so I don't think that mandatory detention is a solution.
While some have expressed their opposition to detention, the government has been re-elected in spite of these policies. In fact, the 2001 election was a poll particularly fought and won on the issue of asylum seekers. Immigration Minister Amanda Vanstone maintains Australia's system is fair to those most in need.
Some people have to be relocated, resettled. And we are the third largest taker of people in those situations. I think that makes us a very good international citizen. We take advice from the UNHCR as to where our refugees will come from, and in the last couple of years it's been predominantly Africa. About 70% of our load has come from Africa in the last couple of years and probably will for the next few, but as you know, the crises in the world change and the locations change. It has in the past been the Middle East or Asia, but it's Africa at the moment. We want to give priority to the people most in need, so that's where we take our refugees from. We are unwilling to allow people smugglers to say to other people who can afford a people smuggler, hey, psst, you don't need to use the UNHCR system. You don't need to sit in a refugee camp. Come pay me some money and we'll help you breach Australia's borders and dump you there, and you will therefore jump the queue ahead of people in refugee camps. We're not going to tolerate that.
However, refugees like Riz maintain the story is not that simple. Some people can't afford to wait while their claims are processed. Meanwhile, the long time it can take to process refugee claims and appealing decisions by the Immigration Department, the Refugee Review Tribunal and the courts has driven some asylum seekers to despair. Sri Lankan political asylum seeker Sarath Amrasinghe, who is detained in Baxter Detention Centre, went on a hunger strike this month after 3 years in detention and after all legal avenues had been exhausted.
We have been in detention so long, number of years, and the detention life is very, very bad and very stressful. So this situation put us into that condition, and because we felt that we are hopeless, we have already completed our whole process and we got very bad results. So then that stress, that situation made drag us to that experience.
While Sarah's case will be reviewed one last time by the minister, many have also been waiting years to have their appeals against adverse findings heard. There are also concerns over the Immigration Act. The Law Council of Australia claims some asylum seekers, whose home governments will not allow them to return home, can in effect be detained indefinitely. These concerns have prompted the council to investigate legislative alternatives. Law Council President Steve Southwood explains.
What's of particular concern, I think the statistics from the department now show that more than 42 people have been in detention for 4 years, and I think some one or two people have been in detention for as long as 6 years, and it's not good that people are kept in detention for such long periods of time where really their only offence is to come to Australia for the pursuit of a better life.
Other groups such as Chill Out, standing for children out of detention, maintain Australia is breaking its international obligations to children. Coordinator Alana Sherry.
On the legal side of it, the reason we are particularly opposed to the detention of children, because of course we're also opposed to the mandatory, indefinite and arbitrary detention of adults, but with children, is that there's a treaty, an international human rights treaty called the Convention on the Rights of the Child, that is the most widely ratified human rights treaty ever in the world. The UN General Assembly adopted it in 1989 and Australia ratified it in 1990. One of the most important parts of that treaty, Article 37, says that no child shall be detained, and if they are, it should only be as a matter of last resort. In Australia, it's first resort.
A recent report by the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission also claimed detaining children was a violation of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child. The report called for all detained children to be released. Immigration Minister Amanda Vanstone.
Some people believe we are. We don't believe we are. Look, you've just put to me a view. It's a view with which I disagree.
However, the department has developed a halfway system for some children and mothers. Residential housing accommodation, which while not the maximum security conditions of a detention centre, has been described as a golden cage by one of the detainees. It's a system involving houses on a guarded street, where detainees have to be escorted to go shopping. The minister maintains this is necessary.
The only other alternative, of course, would be to say, oh well, if you come with children, we'll let you out into the community freely. Now, the consequence of that will be that people smugglers will load children onto the boats, these terrible boats, some of which have sunk, because that's a green light to people smugglers. If you've got kids on board, you've got a good chance. And we will not give a green light to people smugglers.
While the government remains adamant about the need for the mandatory detention system, there has been a softening of policy on other fronts. The government has increased its refugee and humanitarian placement scheme by 50%, enabling 2,000 extra refugees languishing in camps to be allowed into Australia. This move has been welcomed by the Refugee Council of Australia. Are you happy with the way the government is managing the war on terror, and are you happy with the legislation that has been passed?
I think they're actually slow to react, so I think they're probably knee-jerk reactions, which are generally happening pretty slowly, but it's new, so I think they're doing okay.
I think go for it. I think they should. I want to walk around the streets safe.
like in a lot of cases, there can be a perceived threat and an actual threat. But basically, yeah, I think the government wants to be perceived to be doing things, and that perceived threat is far greater than the actual threat.
There is a saying by the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, that you look for your neighbour before the house. You know, in Arabic, al-jar abladdar. So it's, you know, the neighbour. Who are your neighbours? Because they become family. And I guess in a sense we feel that that's being a bit lost because of the impact of the media and, you know, the war on terror.
Many Australians, like their American counterparts, have been living in fear of a terrorist attack since September 11.
The outrage in Bali.
As Prime Minister John Howard noted, October, the war was brought very much closer to home when terrorists bombed a nightclub in Bali, Indonesia, in October 2002, killing 202 people, including 88 Australians and 38 Indonesians. But while there is a high level of fear about the terrorist threat from within, there is also concern among civil libertarians about the raft of anti-terrorism legislation passed since 2002. Vicky Sentis is coordinator of the University of Technology Sydney's Community Legal Centre, which is a member of the Civil Rights Network. She explains further.
I suppose what we've seen in Australia since the passing of some 19 pieces of anti-terrorism legislation is, on paper, the laws are incredibly repressive. They go much further than even the US Patriot Act. You know, we've seen a huge erosion on civil liberties, removal of the right to silence, extension of the time that suspects and non-suspects can be detained by ASIO, new criminal offences based on this very, very broad definition of a terrorist organisation, which doesn't necessarily need to have anything to do with violent terrorist acts.
George Williams, director of the Gilbert and Tobin Centre of Law at the University of New South Wales, says the laws are out of proportion with the threat posed by terrorism in Australia. In particular, the ASIO 2002 legislation is of some concern because it removes the right to silence and also captures non-suspects under the law.
The new law we've passed for our Secret Intelligence Service, ASIO, actually provides for the detention of non-suspects. It could be a journalist, it could be anyone who's got information, for up to a week, and forces them to reveal their information or be punished with 5 years in jail. That goes further than other countries which do have detention regimes, because in those countries, those regimes focus on suspects and on aliens. They don't tend to focus on ordinary people who've just come across some information.
There have also been claims that the ASIO law may be violating the UN Convention on Civil and Political Rights. Attorney General Philip Ruddock denies these claims and maintains the laws are justified.
Well, all the advice I have is it doesn't. I mean, sometimes people identify particular paragraphs in documents, give them an extended meaning and suggest that they in some way bind us. We don't breach our treaty obligations, we honour them. But the point I've made is that when you've got to marry up some of the general statements in those treaties with, say, the Universal Declaration on Human Rights, we've got an obligation to provide for the safety and security and right to life of your own people. Sure, you're going to have some people have different views about where the balance should be.
While a crackdown in civil liberties is disconcerting, some groups claim further that mainly Muslims and Arabs are being targeted under the laws. In particular, critics point to one law under the Criminal Code, which endows the Attorney General with the power to prescribe certain organisations as terrorists. Mr Ruddock denies the laws have a racial or religious target.
I would just make the point in relation to these matters that the laws don't target Muslims.
They target
terrorists. And we certainly won't withdraw laws where the organisations that have been identified, have been named by the United Nations as terrorist organisations. Now, these aren't laws that ban them. They're laws that deal with defining them as terrorist organisations so that the offences that are created under the Act apply. You can't raise money for them. You can't belong to them. You can't train with them. I don't think those sorts of laws are unreasonable in relation to terrorist organisations. Most of the organisations, I think all but about three, were specifically named by the United Nations.
Ju Chung Tam, a law lecturer at La Trobe University, says the evidence points to a different conclusion because so far all people charged under the new laws have been Muslim and all organisations banned have been Muslim.
The Department of Parliamentary Library actually came out with a recent, quite excellent research note entitled The Politics of Prescription, basically examining organizations been banned and have not been banned. So the Tamil Liberation Tigers, for example, according to this note, has got known presence in Australia, engages in politically motivated violence, and has not been banned. Whereas organizations like Palestinian Islamic Jihad, which have no known presence in Australia, do not intend to attack Australian interests, have been banned.
Alan Jones comments.
It's 7 minutes after 7 o'clock on Friday, June 4. We've all had September 11.
However, in the current climate, people are increasingly unlikely to speak out about adverse experiences, especially with security organisations. Lawyer Stephen Hopper, who is the Australian representative of Guantanamo Bay detainee Mamdou Habib, has also represented 16 families raided by ASIO since 2001.
When these raids happen, it's unlikely that someone will face charges. And when someone's house is raided, it's usually quite visible to the neighbours in the street, or it might get out to the media, or other people may know, and a certain stigma is associated with ASIO coming around to your house. People think you're a terrorist or a terrorist sympathiser. So people don't want to go out and be identified as being raided by ASIO. They fear they'll be persecuted, and, you know, I think that's a reasonable belief in the current environment we live in.
A recent report by the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission backs up claims that the Muslim population is feeling scared and targeted because of the war on terror. A Muslim community worker from a high Muslim population area, going under the name of Mariam, feels further laws which allow for prosecutions for associating with a terrorist organisation have put many Muslims off interacting with strangers at all.
A lot of community organisations are welfare organisations and try to assist in settlement services, but I guess some people may be scared even to seek that assistance because they're scared of their name being put on a list or being caught up in some activity that somebody may deem to be of a national security threat or something like that. And these are everyday issues that people are having to grapple with and to understand, and I guess they're not really sure where they stand, and I guess that's only through education can you sort of overcome that.
Mr. Ruddock maintains these fears are unfounded, as only a small percentage of Muslims are coming up against these laws. However, Stephen Hopper notes that while the majority of Muslims are unlikely to encounter police and security agencies, the fear the population is facing is all the more real for the fact that many came to Australia fleeing oppression in search of a free and open society.
A lot of these people came here with the belief that Australia was a free country where this sort of thing didn't happen. And now they're seeing, perhaps from their perspective, the early warning sign, where government agencies and intelligence agencies are given increasing powers, and there's limited safeguards and limited courses for quick redress in place to keep those organisations accountable.
Mr. Hopper also maintains there's not enough accountability against problems to do with confiscated belongings and restrictions on travel following an ASIO raid.
I think we're lacking a suitable counterbalance. You know, difficulties we find, for instance, as an ancillary to raids or ASIO investigations, a number of people's Australian passports have been confiscated and cancelled. These matters can be addressed through the AAT in the security division. However, the rules there do allow for lawyers and applicants to be excluded from proceedings and to be excluded from certain parts of the evidence. I think that's problematic.
However, one area which has been the subject of criticism is Australia's acceptance of a trial regime that has questionable rules of engagement and evidence, namely the Guantanamo Bay Military Tribunal that will try Australians David Hicks and Mamdou Habib, because we currently have no laws in place to charge them. This capitulation to American power is seen as an anathema to many, especially since the Law Council released a report confirming major flaws in the trial process. Law Council President Stephen Southwood.
The report of Lex Lazary QC really does confirm what was the suspicion of the Law Council, that under military commissions it's impossible for such people to get a fair trial.
George Williams, Director of the Gilbert and Tobin Centre of Law at the University of New South Wales, agrees.
I think the jurisdiction that is now being recognised over the Australians in Guantanamo Bay is not so direct that there's anything in our law that recognises it. It's really happened through our acquiescence and lack of involvement. So I think it's its hands-off approach that says, well, we're simply allowing the American authorities to do what they want, and I think that does set a very bad precedent.
In the 2001 election, the government won office and popularity for its policies of being tough on terrorists and refugees. But some observers, like the UN Association's Margaret Reynolds, note that this year's election may be an indication of where public sentiment is heading on refugees.
The way in which Australians have, in fact, warmed to asylum seekers and become their friends is a story yet to be told. And I think we've seen in the previous pre-election period that although this issue was not on the agenda, the reason it wasn't on the agenda was that clearly attitudes have softened.
Alana Sherry from Chillout also believes a change in public sentiment is occurring.
Perhaps it has to come from the bottom, as is happening right now, with just ordinary people making friends with refugees. As a priest in a remote Western Australian town that has welcomed Afghan young men working in their abattoir said to me recently, it's all about love. It's just friendships. And this is the way that things, I think, that the community mood changes.
In relation to legislation surrounding the war on terror, coalitions are forming to counter what are perceived to be moves to impinge on key civil rights. Community lawyer Vicky Sentis explains further.
The community legal sector is very interested in developing a series of seminars, not only with individuals in the community, but also targeted towards community workers, so that we can look at empowering organisations, non-government organisations, who service people to be able to understand the laws themselves so they can assist their clients as well.
Legal expert George Williams maintains a Bill of Rights is one way to protect Australia from repressive laws.
The onus on us is not to ask, well, do we need a Bill of Rights, or to look through our own eyes of someone who might be a white middle-class Australian, but to look through the eyes of someone who really needs protection, someone for whom human rights protection is crucial.
Attorney General Philip Ruddock maintains that all the laws which were passed with bipartisan support are required to fight the war on terror.
I see them all as having been essential in the changed circumstances in which we're operating since September 11, since the planned attack on Australia's interests in Singapore, since the tragedy of Bali and the attack on the Australian mission also in Indonesia. The situation has not ameliorated, hasn't changed. There are people who still target us because of who we are, what we are, and they target not only us but our interests.
No one would deny that the government has a duty and a right to protect its borders and to protect its citizens from terrorist attack. However, in the more vulnerable sections of the community and in the general public, there are some concerns about the way these rights are being enforced.
Australia, or the Australian government, has, I would argue, overreacted to situations. There is a problem, clearly, with people arriving unannounced on our shores, but there are other ways to deal with it rather than having very draconian, reactive legislation. Similarly, there is a serious need to address terrorism and what Australia's role should be, but undermining the fundamental civil liberties of Australians is not the way to go about that either.
FSRN correspondent Erica Voles with that special documentary looking at Australia's human rights engagements in the 21st century. We'll be back tomorrow with our regular newscast. In Berkeley, I'm Deepa Fernandes.